Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Republic Education Call for the United States of America and our Republican form of self-governance for November 26, 2024 at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. I'm Phyllis Marie, and I'll start this call with a devotional. And this is based on Psalms 118, verse 24, and Psalms 116, verse 17. This is the day that I have made. As you rejoice in this day of life, it will yield up to you precious gifts and beneficial training. Walk with me along the high road of thanksgiving, and you will find all the delights I have made ready for you. To protect your thankfulness, you must remember that you reside in a fallen world where blessings and sorrows intermingle freely. A constant focus on adversity defeats many Christians. They walk through a day that is brimming with beauty and brightness, seeing only the grayness of their thoughts. Neglecting the practice of giving thanks has darkened their minds. How precious are my children who remember to thank me at all times. They can walk through the darkest days with joy in their hearts because they know that the light of my presence is still shining on them. Rejoice in this day that I have made, for I am your steadfast companion. We, the people of the Republic, are peaceful, lawful, and private. And our Declaration states that when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. And before I turn this over to the next speaker, I just want to mention that if there are new people on the call this evening and you would like to be added to our distribution list so that you get the notices and the attachments that we have, just send me an email at blueridge1121@gmail.com. And this address will be given to you a little bit later in the call as well. But that's blueridge1121@gmail.com, and I'll make sure that you get the notices in the future. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Marilyn, who has her moment. Go ahead.
Thank you, Phyllis. And welcome everyone to the call tonight. I've received new information, so this is a correction from what we spoke last week. It involves We the People too. They have a new plan for the future. They've decided to open their PMA to everyone. We will not be asked to sign an NDA stating that we are U.S. citizens or have U.S. residency. So remember to enjoy your family and friends this Thursday night, and join us next week on our health call. Join us on our next health call, which is going to be December 12th. So, Daryl, you're up.
Okay, well, thank you, Marilyn and Phyllis, and welcome, everybody. I don't have my computer, they're picking on me again, and I lost my computer this afternoon, so I won't be able to share a screen, but Phyllis is going to put up the second page of the document that the presenter is going to be sharing tonight. So you may want to open up that document on the bottom that is attached if you want to follow along. It's a 4-page document. It's titled The 3-Step Administrative Process. And also attached is the rules for the call. We're not going to read them, but they're there for your perusal. But we just ask that, as Phyllis said, you know, to stay muted, you know, until the presenter opens up for questions. And you can mute with *6 and unmute with *6. But try to keep the background noise quiet so we have a good recording. And also attached is a friend of Jim Wright's. And Jim Wright was the one who actually started this movement to restore our guaranteed Republican form of government based upon the intent of the 4 organic laws. That's the intent. And he passed away here a few weeks back. And Mike from Pennsylvania was very close to him in working together. He would prepare all the papers because Jim didn't have a typewriter or a computer or nothing. So Mike was very instrumental on this. And so that is still posted for anybody that's new and would like to see it. And also there's a document. It's basically networking contacts for other groups. It gives the day and the time for the calls. So we're trying to merge together with as many groups as would be willing to work together, as we have one country and we have a standard of laws. We have a guaranteed constitutional Republican form that has been abused by this here corporation that has taken things over. So we're trying to restore back to the original intent and building it from the bottom up, where it's the people. God created the people. The people created government, and our effort is to restore the authority back to the people. So the people are in charge from the bottom up, and it's not a top down like a monarchy. So with that, I don't think there's anything else. But Kent, if you want to step forward introduce the presenter for this evening.
Okay, Daryl, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you sound clear.
Okay, thank you, Daryl. We also want to thank Phyllis. We want to thank Marilyn, Daryl, Lady Linda Louise, the people behind putting this call together. But most of all, we want to thank the presenters that come to the call and the listeners that tune into the call. So tonight, I have the honor and pleasure of doing the introduction for the gentleman that's going to speak. The name is Ray. You'll have a special treat tonight, I believe. And the reason I'm introducing him is because I met him about 40 years ago when both he and I were about half the age we are now. And I met him in the New York City metropolitan area when we were conducting constitutional law meetings. And at that time, some of you may recognize these names. We were dealing with George Gordon, Bob Holstrom, Rudy Bodie with his writs, John and Sharon Voss with the National Commodity and Barter Association way back then, and, of course, many more. So Ray, like I and many others here, has been around for a long time. He's been exposed to many different issues over the course of time, and we should never discount the time and experience that people have. With Ray, he feels an obligation to do the right thing, as I do and as many of the rest of us do. So I'm going to leave that as a short introduction, and I'm going to let Ray introduce himself and tell his story about how he got involved in this, what he's learned, and how he's learned to actually challenge this system. Ray?
Well, thank you, Ken. wow. Now we're going back some 50 years, 50 years. I was a professional actor, singer on Broadway, and I got ripped off by the IRS in 1974. And I won't tell you the particulars, but it was BS. And I told them that, and they smiled at me kind of arrogantly and said, well, you can always peel it. And that's what got me started on this road. I had no intention of ever pursuing law. And I said, all right, you won the battle, but you're going to lose the war. And that began a 50-year journey. I can't tell you how many gurus I've gone through, how many things I've done that have worked, some haven't. I spent about four or five different occasions at compliments of the various county jails, because our system is so incredibly corrupt. My first advice to anybody is stay out of the courts. They are not for you. They are strictly there to make money. And so one of the things that we can use is this three-step administrative process, which they have created for their own use, and now we can use it. And the intent of the process is to place the burden of proof on them while you stay in honor and remain outside the corporate system of law. And I should put the word law in parentheses, because it's not law, it's statutes. 1870 or so, Barr came to England, to America, and transferred our law into statutes. And we'll get into more about statutes in a minute and later on. But anyway, this is a process that's designed to at least force them to admit that it is all BS. And it is. Our monetary system is corrupt. Our law system is corrupt. And, of course, our government system is corrupt. And that goes all the way from the top down to the county levels. So they're manipulating the law. They're manipulating the words that they use, which is why a lot of times things we used to work don't, because they go together and they say, okay, well, we're just going to change the definition. And all of a sudden, it doesn't apply to you. So there's a three-step process involved. The first one, of course, is to get them to specifically verify and validate their claim, which they cannot do because it's fraud. You present what you believe are the flaws in their claim or the defects in their presumptions, and you extend the opportunity for them to prove the validity of their position. Stop me if I'm talking too fast. I highly recommend that you get a copy of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. It's codified in 15 U.S.C. 1692. It's only 23 pages long. It's easy to read and download. And when you do, focus on the following sections. All right. I'm assuming you guys have pencil and paper handy. Section C, communication in connection with debt collection. Section D, harassment or abuse. E, false and misleading representations. F, unfair practices. G, validation of debt. I, legal action by debt collectors. J, furnishing certain deceptive forms. K, civil liability. And L, administrative enforcement. Which we should put that in parentheses, because they're not going to enforce anything, because it's a money, it's a money cow, what do we call it? A cash cow. So you're not going to find many of them who are going to enforce the administrative laws, but because we're in a state of flux now and the common law is coming back, you will have a record of their misdeeds, which someone's going to have to pay for down the road. Meanwhile, it's very intimidating because you're forcing them to come clean and say, yeah, this is all a sham. remember, the statutes, this statute, 15 U.S.C. 1692, is binding upon them, the corporations, not you. Now, why is that? Well, because you're not a corporate thing, even though they call you that. You're a living man or a woman. And the funny thing about statutes is nowhere in the 5 million statutes that they have do they talk about a living man or a woman. It's always a thing. You're a resident, you're a driver, you're a taxpayer, you're an employee. You follow what I'm saying? Those are all things. And when you get communication from them, it's always addressed to someone in all capital letters. And in the old days, when they used to teach English in schools, you knew the difference between a common noun and a proper noun. And the only way to represent a living man or a woman was through upper and lowercase letters. All uppercase and all lowercase were common. So by the mere fact that they're calling you that tells you right off the bat that they are not talking to you as a man or a woman. They're talking to a thing which they have created by the definitions in their statutes. Again, I don't mean to get too, to go down that rabbit hole too far. But anyway, so let's talk about this notice of dispute. In good faith, you give them an opportunity to comply with the request you've placed in your notice, or they may rebut that with which they disagree, citing constitutionally compliant fact, law, and evidence in support. Good luck with that. If they are relying on a particular statute, they must also cite the specific implementing regulation. I don't know if you've heard of this or not. The statute by itself has no force and effect of law because it is too vague. It needs the implementing regulation because the implementing regulation tells you to whom the statute applies, who's in charge of enforcing it, what the penalties are for a violation. So without that, the statute is worthless. And yet that's all they use. And so what you're asking them to do is, if you're citing the statute, show me. I've had the IRS boxed up for years because they can't tell me what the implementing regulation is. And that's because the implementing regulation for most of Title 26 collection activity is found in Title 27 of the Code of Federal Regulations, which regulates alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. So what in the world are they doing using those statutes against you? Same with the Motor Vehicle Code. If you look up the definitions, you're not a driver. A driver is one who operates a motor vehicle for hire. A motor vehicle is a conveyance used to transport passengers or cargo for hire. So where is all this this lawfare that's forcing you to register your car, get insurance, and pay these tickets when you're not engaged in commerce and the cops have no authority to stop you? But they don't know. They are paid to enforce the statutes, not the law. They don't know the law, and that's for good reason. Most of your administrative people don't know laws. All they know is what they've been told to enforce. Anyway, I digress. Okay, in good faith, you give them an opportunity to comply with the request you placed in your notice, or they may rebut that with which they disagree. If they are, I told you all that already. The response that they give you must be received within 20 days of your receipt of your notice, exclusive of day of service. And that's right out of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So you're basically saying, I don't think what you're doing is right, but you know, if you can back it up or whatever, let me know. You got 20 days from when you received this, exclusive of the day you received this. And I can guarantee you 99% of the time, 99.9% of the time, you're not going to get a satisfactory response. They're going to send you either a carbon copy of what they've already sent you or something else, but they're not going to address the stuff that is a notice of dispute. And as I heard someone mention before, you can download this. I've enclosed this so that you can look at it, copy it. And again, it's called a notice of dispute. This is what some people have used. Again, do not use anything verbatim that you don't understand. And certainly until you got a feeling for it and you understand what all the words mean, I wouldn't use it either. I mean, I'm giving you an AK 45 or 54 or whatever it is now, and I'm telling you, don't hurt yourself. Because if you act differently from what you write, they know you don't know what you're talking about, and they'll have their way with you. The whole idea of this process is to keep you out of the court and to keep you away from them and emphasize the fact that they have no authority over you, which, as you heard when they read the Declaration of Independence, they don't. Government has no authority over men and women. And that happened after 18 in the Civil War, when the bar came over and the crown took over our finances and the Vatican took over our politics. So let's start from the top. And this is a fictitious person, by the way. Daphne Yvonne colon Cleveland, and there's a footnote right after the word Cleveland. Now, the reason for the colon is because Cleveland is not her real name. It's the family's name. And then historically, whenever you, and again, we lived within 10 miles of where we're born and raised. So people refer to you by your first and second name. Oh, that's Joe Allen of the Cleveland family. So the colon takes the place of the family of. If you were in Ireland, it would be O'Cleveland. If you were in Scotland, Mac Cleveland. If you were in Germany, Von Cleveland. You see what I'm saying? Cleveland is the family name, it's not yours. But your first and second name are, that's on your birth certificate. And it should be in upper and lower case only. Now, the next line says mail delivery location. You don't have an address. And here again, this is a play on words that they do with us all the time. Give us your name and address. Your address, an address is a fixed location. You're a living man or woman. You live wherever you are. If you're visiting the grocery store, that's where you're living. If you visit your friend's house, that's where you're living. If you're walking through the park, that's where you're living. You don't have a fixed location. So we call it what it is. It's a mail delivery location. That's your mailbox. And oh, by the way, you don't own it. The post office does. So it's counterproductive to use that as an address. It's a mail delivery. It's where you receive mail. It's not yours, but that's where you receive mail. And then you have your city, state, and I usually put the post, the zip code in parentheses because I don't live in a federal zone, and that's what it is. So I call it a postal extension. That way they can't make any assumptions that you're living in a postal region, a federal zone. And I hope you're writing this down if you need to ask questions about it. Next, we go to who this is addressed to, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You always send it certified mail. You don't necessarily a return receipt request because the post office has a track and confirm website that you can access real easy, and it'll tell you the day and time it was delivered. Now, Ray, this is the reason for this thing. This is there's a presentment that you're responding to. It's a bill. It's a... something you have to do. Somehow or other, they're trying to get you into a contract. And then, of course, you give their, not your account number, their account number, because you don't have an account number. You're a living man at work. So that's what we call you. The presentment dated such and such relative to your account number, such and such. That's them. That's not you. And then on the next line, notice of dispute. And you notice underneath it says notice to agent is notice to principal. Notice to principal is notice to all agents. So nobody can claim they don't know anything about it. The next line is whether it's going to be madam or sir, depending on whether it's a woman or a man. And now the first paragraph. I am in receipt of your anonymous paper referenced above because normally it's never signed. Looking over your paper, I do not see anything upon which to base your claim of indebtedness, nor anything creating a contractual nexus between your company and Daphne Cleveland. Remember, you just use her first and second name. Therefore, your claim is disputed, as is your authority to contact Daphne Cleveland. I'll give you a minute or two to write your questions. Now, next paragraph. Pursuant to your obligation under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, 15 U.S.C. 1692, and sequence, And as a prerequisite to any further attempts to perfect your claim, you are hereby requested to document, validate, and verify your claim by complying in good faith with the following requests. Now, over the past, well, I don't know, I've been doing this for 20 years now. I don't think any of them have responded in good faith. But here's the first request. And again, they're trying to get you to contract with them. That's all this is about. Because if you contract with them, they own you. So, number one, please provide a copy, certified true and correct, of the original contract agreement bearing the signatures of the original parties and state under penalty of perjury that you or your principal are in possession of same and can produce the original for my inspection and or that of a judge should this matter go to trial. That's simple enough. If you're trying to enforce the terms of a contract, show me the contract. Where's the beef? And it must have my signature. And by the way, as a living man and woman, you don't have a signature. Only things have signatures. You have an autograph. Number two, please produce a full and complete ledgering of the account certified by the custodian of the records, verifying the obligation you're now attempting to collect. Now, Spears versus Brennan, all right, was a wonderful case because it laid it out. Just sending you a bunch of past due notices or a bunch of monthly statements does not constitute a ledgering of the account. It must be certified by the custodian of the records. Why? Because there has to be some kind of truth here. I mean, I can make up all kinds of numbers and send them to you. It doesn't mean you owe me anything. But if I'm willing to go and certify under penalty of perjury that this is true, then it's a different story. And but they don't, because they don't have access to those. More than likely, when you talk about collection actions, they're not the original debtors, or quote, debtors. They're usually some of those who purchased it, but we'll get to that next. Please verify under penalty of perjury, that's just the third one now, that as a third-party debt collector, you have not purchased evidence of an alleged debt and are proceeding with collection activity in the name of the original alleged creditor or produce documentation from the original creditor attesting that you are authorized to act for them. That has never happened. By this time, they just leave you alone because there's too many things that they're going to have to lie about. Number four, if this evidence of debt has been purchased or assigned from the original owner of the debt, please provide documentation of the assignment and how much was paid. Mortgages are great ones. They assign those mortgages over to the collection people all the time. Your response is required to be received within 20 days of receipt hereof. When corresponding, you are to use the mail delivery location indicated at the top of this notice of dispute. Correspondence addressed other than that indicated will constitute prima facie evidence of fraudulent intent. Now, in all capital letters, take notice. Your failure to timely comply as stipulated herein constitutes a dishonor. And such time, your presentment will be returned. And again, here's a footnote. It says, but a copy will be retained to be used as evidence should this matter escalate. Acceptance denied for fraud. Now, next paragraph. Again, all capital letters. Take notice. Absent compliance herewith, any action taken to collect this unresolved disputed debt constitutes a violation of law and subjects your company and the perpetrator to statutory damages of, but not limited to, $1,500 per occurrence per individual. And then there's footnote 3, C18 U.S.C. 1690, I'm sorry, that should be 15 U.S.C. 1692 and the Uniform Commercial Code. And incidentally, they're also liable for criminal and civil penalties, too. Now, last paragraph. take additional notice under no condition are you or anyone connected associated with your company to contact Daphne Cleveland by phone or email. And it's signed, all rights reserved, UCC 1-308, Daphne Cleveland. Now, UCC, that's a Uniform Commercial Code, 1-308 says that you refuse to be held liable to the undisclosed terms of any contract that you have not entered into voluntarily, knowingly, and with full exposures, even compensation. And you refuse to be held liable for the terms of any benefits that are to any undisclosed commercial agreement or contract. In other words, hey, if you're not telling me anything up front, how am I supposed to, how do you expect me to respond intelligently? Oh, because we're told to do what you're told. Don't ask questions. Don't, you know, keep your head down and everything will be all right. So this is just round one. And more than likely, you won't hear from them. And they're hoping you don't know what to do next. And that would be stage two. And I guess we'll cover that in another meeting. That's when you issue them a notice of fault. And that's when it gets real interesting, because now you can start adding monetary damages and liabilities, because, hey, if they don't cure the fault, again, you're going to issue them another extension of 10 days because they dishonored your notice of dispute. Now you're giving them 10 days to cure their dishonor and do the right thing, which shows what? You're acting in honor, and you're giving them every opportunity to do the right thing. And you're also warning them with your notice of fault of what the consequences are going to be if they don't cure their fault. And we'll talk about that next time. Now, I guess I'm open for questions now.
Okay. Anybody got a question? Press star 6 to unmute.
Will that work against the county? I'm sorry, this is Sherry on Washington. Would this be available to be used against the county, like a plea and abatement?
Used against the county for abatement?
If you've ever used something similar to this against the county.
Well, you have to understand, it's all about money. And they're trying to get you to contract. And this is a very hard thing when government talks to you, because they want you under their thumb. And you don't want to go there. You have to let them know right off the bat that you are not the person. You're a living man and woman, or man or woman. In your case, you're a living woman. And that is not you. Basically, it's an insult, because they're calling you a common man. Not really a living man or woman. Who, by the way, is the boss of the government. But getting back to the county, you have to understand, these people who write to you, and most of your administrators of government, don't know the law. They only know what they've been taught. They've been taught about procedures, but they haven't been taught about the legal or the lawful background of why this thing has to be the way it is. So you would want to tell them, yes, in the case of the county, what statute are you relying on? What's the implementing regulation? Why do you say that I owe you this? Now, if it has to do with land, there's another one that gets you for it. Because you don't have private land, you have residential property. If you check your tax bill, there are five categories. There's manufacturing, there's commercial, there is agricultural, there is residential, And then there's a category 5, and it's called other, and it's left blank. Guess what should be written there? This is not a trick question. What do you think would you write there?
Private land.
Private, yeah. Because why? This country was built on the principle of private ownership of land. Not principle, the right. You have a right to private ownership of land. You can't tax a right. You can't regulate a right. It's absolute. But they get around it by calling you a resident and residential property. And they have no way of backing it up once you start calling attention to the fact that they're playing with words. So your abatement, again, you may have already started something with them where you allowed them to presume that you were a resident and that the land that you own was really theirs, because when you bought the land, who got the title? Secretary of State.
Yeah, it's a big mix. They know. They know it's been going on for 3 years, and I've got my Board of Equalization hearing coming up, and I'm going to put them straight. You know, they're criminal, like you said, and I don't want to take any more of your time. So other people probably want to ask questions, but I know God is in control, and that's why I got the hearing, and God's going to have the victory. It isn't going to be Sherry getting the victory. It's going to be God Almighty.
I don't understand. You can rescind the signature that appears, and you can rescind the you giving the land over to them or filing it with them.
Oh, and I have. I've done all of that. Yes, sir. I've done all of that. They just continue to roll around in a meat grinder, and like I said, God will have his way with them. Beat them.
Just don't let them call you by the all capital names, and don't let them call you a resident or a residential property. Be careful of words. That's a lawyer's stock and trade, is their ability to manipulate language, and they do it very well. They've been at it for 150 years. So make sure what you're saying, and you're knowing what they're saying, and you're calling attention to the fact that they are mislabeling you and your land. And where do they get the authority to tax private land? So your notice of dispute would have to do with, have you ever heard the phrase quo warranto? That's a Latin for by what authority?
Yes, and that's what's going to happen to both of them. The treasurer's their father and son, and they're both going to get a quo warranto. I'm going to start a petition this next spring against both of them. The assessor's not even lawfully in office. He wasn't bonded for 60 days. He's in a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you hopefully will be able to utilize is your county sheriff. Supposedly, Trump has sent out a notice to the sheriffs, and now we're going to be under common law, and their loyalty is to the people, not to the corporation. See, the sheriff is the highest ranking law officer in the county. And her oath is to the people. And he has an obligation to protect you and to serve you. Now, you say, sir, I assume you have an oath of office. Well, good. I accept your oath of office, and I will hold you to it. Now you have a private contract with your sheriff where he has to obey his oath of office. If he doesn't, he's in perjury of oath. He loses his bond, and he becomes personally liable for any damages or liabilities that he has created. And this is a whole lot of stuff on short notice. And I maybe even know. Tune in again later when we get to the other statements, and we'll develop this thing further.
Yes, sir. I was hoping that I could get your information and talk to you privately. I already emailed Phyllis, so I'll email her and pass her my information.
All right, that might be better. because I'm sure not everybody wants to hear this. But we must start exercising who we are and not let them put us into, you know, the Wizard of Oz. No, we are living men and women. We are the boss. You can't do that to living men and women. You can only do that to the things that you create. That's why they have created these names that they're using, because they created them. It's not yours. So you just have to keep reminding them, we have, I'll tell you when we talk privately, because there's another, another nail in their coffin, and that is when you take over executorship of the estate the government created when you were born. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or not. When you're born, the birth certificate was really a bond. They floated on the stock market. They used that as collateral for the borrowing that FDR was using to raise this great new country of his that he wanted. But they didn't have the kind of money, so they had to borrow it. And they used your certificate of live birth with your footprint on it. And they did some kind of actuarial estimate that you would make create $900,000 of wealth in your lifetime, which is 10% of the bond. The bond was $9 million. And at 7% interest a year, you can imagine what that bond is worth now. But because they did that in your name, which is involuntary servitude under international law, they had to give you an out, which they did, because they could only be the executor of your estate until you reach the age of majority. In my years, it was 21. Yours is probably 18. And your parents gave them that authority when they applied for a marriage license. And if you read the application for a marriage license, it says the state will be the guardian of the issue of the marriage. I mean, everywhere you turn, they got us locked in with this manipulation of our language. So anyway, now that you are acknowledging that you are a living man or a woman, and that you are the executor of the estate, you are above, that's the highest level. In the government. That's higher than the Supreme Court. But another topic for another day. I'm getting way off of this issue here. Talk to Phyllis, and if she gives you my number, fine.
Thank you. I emailed her. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And I have worked up on that. I look forward to talking to you. I'm just real excited right now. Praise God.
All right, let's
is there anybody else with a question? Is there anybody else with a question?
Daryl, this is Kent.
Okay, go ahead, Kent.
Yeah. Ray, could you elaborate a little bit on how you accept their oath of office? We have a gentleman that's on this call frequently by the name of Dave from Kansas, and he has a more formal process for actually accepting their oath of office, and it works quite well for him. So I'm interested in knowing when you make the statement, exactly how you might do that. And then if Dave is listening to the call, maybe he would like to comment also. Thank you.
All right. I've not had to use it myself. I know someone who has and has used it successfully, and he simply lets them know that, you invite them to make a statement that, yes, they have taken an oath of office. Good. Now, I, as a man, accept your oath of office, and I hold you to specific performance pursuant to the backside of the Bill of Rights, which means they have to do everything that the Constitution says they have to do. He's had cops walk away. He's had several things happen when he's accepted their oath of office. One judge got up and left the bench. in court.
I might want to add something to this. Have you ever had a situation where they've come back and said that they actually took a corporate oath of office and not an oath of office to the Constitutional Republic or the jure republic, and therefore, you know, their oath was not to the republic? Has that issue ever come up?
Well, then you're saying basically that we're in a court of British courts of admiralty. This is not an American
mm-hmm.
court.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing here?
Well,
and also, just check out the flag to see it's got a gold fringe on it.
Mm-hmm.
And under courts of British equity and British admiralty, the judge is the captain of the ship. And the judge, whatever the law is, whatever the judge says it is. He can play the law, break the law, obey the process, ignore the process, anything he wants. Which is why in the old days, if you ever saw these old movies of people standing in line to go into court, they all had stuff to give the judges. You had, you know, the highest, the most expensive thing you had with you. And those who had the best ones got their, then it hasn't changed. You have as much justice as you can afford. And the higher, you know, the more money you have, the better chances of getting justice. So I've not had to use it, but he did, and he was very successful with it.
Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately, I can't give you any more particulars because, again, I haven't really gone into it. There's only so many hours a day. There's so much else going on, in case you hadn't noticed.
Okay, is there anybody else?
The oath of office is really important, and you want to, especially if you're in the presence of a witness, get someone to witness it and make sure that they have an oath of office, that you accept the oath of office, and you are holding them to it.
Okay, is there anybody else that got a question? Press star 6 if you need it. So who is that? Somebody was trying to say something?
It's Cheryl. When you said press star 6, I did, and that muted me.
Okay. Go ahead, Cheryl. Florida.
Yeah. So my question is, you know, you say that it's admiralty, and if you're going into an admiralty court, you would also have a bill of lading. You can't go, I mean, you know, that's the way that works. So I've never seen a bill of lading in a court. I've never seen them issue a bill of lading. So how can you call it admiralty?
It's an admiralty court because when they issue the paperwork, there are three bonds. That's your bill of lading. There's a big bond, a performance bond.
A big performance, and that does not create a bill of lading.
Excuse me?
How do you justify that? I mean, that's we know that there's a bid performance and payment bond.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with a ship? It has nothing to do with a bill of lading. Those are bonds.
Yes, yes, I understand that. The bill of lading, again, you don't understand. They don't follow the law. They don't follow the rules. It's all show. One of
right.
the things
that I
you
get
know you're in admiralty is the fact that there's a gold fringe on the flag. That's an admiralty
no,
flag.
No, that's not true. Whoa. I've heard from lots of people that admiralty does not have it. That's military. That's a military flag. And
no.
It's also, in some cases, being referred to as a decorative flag. That's
well,
that has nothing to do with admiralty.
On a
Navy ship, you won't see a gold fringe flag. You won't see it. On a Navy ship. So that's actually a boat, which I would think they're in admiralty.
You may or may not see it on a ship, but in a court under admiralty law, you will see it.
That's on the water, though. You're talking about the water. Immorality is on the water.
If you read the Constitution, what was the first complaint they got against King George?
Yeah.
You cut out, Ray. Oh, we might have lost him.
Oh.
He'll have to call back in.
Yeah, I think that
it is a military flag with the gold fringe. But it's we're also operating basically as if we are under war power. Since Roosevelt declared all persons to be under the personage. Okay. Go ahead.
But I understand.
Hey Cheryl,
understand.
Get your own show. Quit arguing.
Well, you know, but it's not appropriate to say
Cheryl,
things.
I think we got Ray back here.
This is Kent. Let's have one person speak at a time and do this in an orderly fashion, please. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree.
Ray, are you back? Ray, are you back? Kent, you want to maybe get a hold of him? He's apparently he lost his connection, and you don't know it.
Okay. Hold on.
But, yes, that Admiralty flag is basically a military flag, and they're holding you under as if you are on the sea and basically under that Admiralty contract law or whatever you want to call it. But that's how they're entrapping us into that thing that's being transported. It's basically human trafficking, and we are the cargo, and they're using us as a surety, you know, for that, for the value that, or for the, whatever the cargo, the name, which is the cargo, they're holding us as the chattel, or the surety for it.
We lost contact.
Ray, are you there?
Yeah, I'm down here. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. If you want to continue where we lost you.
Yeah. You know, this business of Admiralty, they merged Admiralty with Equity. Years ago, we were called the Courts of British Equity. And then they merged that with it. They do all that stuff with the law because why?
Where can I find that? Because, you know, I'm a big reader, and I like to prove what, you know, when you guys say something, most of the time I can't find it. Okay, mm-hmm. So as a researcher, I have a hard time believing what you're saying because I'm a reader and a researcher. So I want to know where finding this stuff because I've never found where Equity and Admiralty came together.
That the British did that. You won't have it in American law stuff. You'll have it in English law.
Okay, but we're not English law.
Well, we don't have access to that here in this country. And they're not going to print it. They don't want people to know what's going on.
Cheryl, when he's talking, Cheryl, stop.
Yeah.
When he's talking, let him finish his. Do not talk over. Nobody can hear anything or make any sense out of what you're saying. When you're talking over, present your little question and then let him respond. And then we're gonna have to let somebody else also ask a question. So, go ahead, Ray. Ray? Did we lose you again? Uh-oh. I don't think Ray knows that he must have got disconnected again. Kent,
okay,
are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Somehow or other, that came in.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Ray.
All right. The problem we have is that the history, even our law, has been messed around with. There are three different constitutions of the United States, for the United States, et cetera, et cetera. You're not going to find this in any, unless you go to, I guess, a major university and you spend at least, or go to the Vatican Library and might find it there. It's hard. It just makes sense when you can judge them by the way they act. And they act, and it's not military. You're right. Admiralty has nothing to do with the military. It has to do with the sea. Where is, the law of the land, for instance, is fixed. Law is immutable. It's there. If it's in the water, it can move. Tides come and go, various things flow upstream, downstream. And so I understand what you're saying. And it's extremely difficult to find out where it is there. I've heard it. I've in research for the past 50 years, I've come across where they've merged equity and admiralty in the British court system. They're not going to tell us that here, just like they didn't tell us a lot of stuff. They tell us that they were going to use our birth certificates as bonds? No. I mean, half the things that we do, they haven't told us about. They just do it. And you have to kind of do deductive reasoning. Well, if they're doing this, then this must be happening. And you keep going back and back and back, and things begin to make sense. It's unfortunately. But as Aldous Huxley, not Aldous Huxley, 1984, what he told us, the Institute of Truth, what did they do? They got rid of the books and converted everything to digital, so that they could change it. And our laws have been changing, and our history has been changing. So, if you want to spend your life, go for it. That's a wonderful, wonderful goal, to find out how British courts of equity merged admiralty law and equity. Now, in this country, they said they've merged equity and law. Law and equity have been merged together. I've heard that said many times. But I don't know if that's going to help you, hon. All I know is that all we can do is what we can do. As living men and women, you can say, no, I don't accept that. We don't say no. We go along, and they keep pushing us. And we are living men and women, and we have not been, empowered yet. We haven't learned that is who we are. We are the boss. Government exists by the consent of the governed. The government doesn't rule the people. The people rule the government. 10th Amendment says those powers not specifically enumerated in the Constitution are reserved for the people and the states. The state, the federal government only had 19 things. That's it. They had, now what? They're ruling every action, every part of our lives. So this has been an ongoing process. We have gone from a constitutional republic to, I don't know what we are now, a socialistic, it's a combination. Yeah, banana republic, yeah. And hopefully that's going to change within the next 2 months. I'm sorry, I haven't been able to answer your question, and I apologize for that, but I've never really delved into admiralty. I had nothing to do with it. I don't want it. It's just like I don't want to know about democracy either, because that's a bastard government.
Right.
I want a republic. Don't talk to me about democracy. Go ahead.
Right. Totally agree with And in my opinion, I'm subject to the primary contract, which is the Constitution. The Constitution didn't have state statutes.
Right.
Okay.
And may I say one thing in correction? The Constitution was for the United States. It was not for the people. It recognized we have inalienable rights, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the Constitution, as the Jeffersonians said during that debate between the Jeffersonians and the Hamiltonians, you know, they said, we don't want a big government. And, you know, we want big government. They said, well, we want to bind the government in the chains of the Constitution. That was why it was written, to keep government
right.
small.
People
right? so
wrote
it, doesn't,
though.
People wrote it, sure. But it
right.
was not for the people. It was for to keep the government in its place.
Right.
The Constitution
and
didn't give us anything.
Okay, let's see
right.
if it wasn't
and we
for
made
us.
And we right. made a huge mistake when we don't hold them to make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. I mean,
right.
they the Constitution
okay.
has never been changed. It's Article You're, 1, Section 10, Clause 1. They've never been changed, and nobody is holding them gold and
okay.
silver, the tender in payment. I tried today.
Okay, Cheryl, do you have a question? Or just...
Like he said, he couldn't answer it. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay,
Thank
is there anybody
much.
Else with a question?
Me, I?
Yeah, who's speaking?
This is Rod in Oregon.
Okay, go ahead, Rod.
Now, real quick, I mentioned this before. You know, I don't know how many might have taken me up on it. But you really want to get your attention and know about history and what's really going on this planet. You need to go to StuPeters.com and watch his video, The Old World Order.
He's a good guy, Stu Peters. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, go to his. It's the first video on his website. It's called The Old World Order. Wait till
mm-hmm.
you see that one if you haven't yet. I yield.
I haven't. Thank you. But we're getting way off the topic here.
Yeah. Is there anybody else with a question on this here three-step process, administrative process?
Mute us, Rod.
Okay. Who is that? Is there somebody wanted to say something? I guess not. Is there anybody else with a question? Press star 6 to unmute.
That was Blue, Daryl, trying to talk.
Okay. Blue, do you have a question? Rod, do you have him muted? Maybe. Okay. Well, if there's no other questions, I'll ask one. Somebody have a question there? Okay. Ray, like when you serve this, can a guy serve it just with the email and effectively enforce it, or does it need
no.
to be sent by certified mail?
The problem with email is you can't prove they got it, and you can't prove you sent it. That's why we have to go through. What?
Yeah, you can, it does show that it was sent on your sent file, but as far as
receiving it,
you know, when they have a .gov website, you know, they're required to, you know, monitor that.
I understand that, but if it's not on paper, it doesn't exist. That's something I learned in law a long time ago, because you can change things that are in a electronic form all you want. You can lose it, you can change it, you can modify it. But if it's on paper, they can't mess with it.
I have a question, Ray. Sherry from Arkansas.
Ahead,
facsimile, would that be different? because that is paper, and you do have a journal or a confirmation page.
You have a confirmation page, yeah, but you can't prove that they got it other than your confirmation page. You can't tell when they got it. And that's, again, why we use the post office, is because when you go to the track and confirm website, it tells you the day and the time that they got it. And that, again, is a neutral third-party witness, not you.
I get that. But, you know, there's quite a few of us on this call that have spent endless amounts of money doing certified mail. And we're at our wit's end. We're spending money that and there's no remedy. They ignore us, and at $8 a pop for certified mail, it's...
Okay. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, I was finished. It's just costly sending certified. That's why I started sending faxes.
Okay, you're sending faxes, and you can prove they got it because you have a verification or a validation of receipt, right?
Yes.
Okay.
On a fax, show that it was transmitted, how many pages, what time, to what phone number, and that it was sent. And I would say I'm dealing with local thiefdoms that had already been put on notice via certified mail.
Right.
So,
well, then you take the next step. If they've already been put on notice and they don't respond, that's when you go to the second level, and that is a notice of fault. And you start laying forth the fact that they have not, they have dishonored you. And now as a result of dishonor, they have entered into a state of fault. And if they don't cure the fault, they're going to owe you X number of dollars. You know, whatever they're saying that you owe them becomes a damage that they have to pay you now. If they're showing you, if there's fraud involved, that's three times the damages. All right?
Mm.
Now, once you send it, you see, you have what's called an unresolved dispute. Under the Uniform Commercial Code, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, they cannot move forward while there is an unresolved dispute. So it's
I think it's
down.
Interesting that you're bringing in the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I'd never even considered that when it comes to the government.
Well,
amazing.
Because it's all about
thank
money.
You.
It's all about it's commerce. You look up your court. They have a Dun & Bradstreet number. So does your city. Everybody's got a Dun & Bradstreet number because you're corporations. It's all corporate. So why not? And
absolutely.
And so it is frustrating when they ignore you. And there's other steps. After the second step, they go into default. Now, default is an interesting statement. That is basically three strikes and you're out. Once they're in default, they have no right or cause of action. They cannot do anything because they're in default. In addition to which, by default and by their silence, they have acquiesced to being held liable for any and all damages. And that can be... any amount you want, depending on how much damage they've done to you and what they've done to you. For instance, in your notice of fault, you can tell them, look, you have my permission for a one-time use of this name so that you may comply and for no other purpose. And a violation of this prohibition is going to cost you $50,000 per occurrence per individual. And you can get a really nice piece of change going there. And then you do a UCC-1, which is a consensual lien, and you file that with the Secretary of State's office, and you put a lien on their company or on them. and you put it on all
if
their
I may.
Assets. Pardon?
If I may.
Yeah.
Hi, Ray. I appreciate all the information you're bringing forward. I got one question. How
yeah.
many times have you been paid?
Oh, forget it. See,
really?
A common law, I mean, a consensual lien is passive. It doesn't pay you anything, but it puts a lien on their stuff. Now, you can hire a debt collecting law firm to go after them, and you say, look, I'll split it with you 50-50, or you get 25% of what you collect.
Have you done that?
I haven't had to.
Really?
Really? I haven't had to use the UCC-1. They just go away. And that's all I wanted to do anyway. I'm not looking to make money off of them. I just wanted to leave me alone.
Well, but you are talking about, you know, you just said you can make some pretty good money, you know, $50,000 fine or whatever.
Yeah.
So you've never invoked any of those fines.
The money you are increasing the liability that they are liable for, and at some time down the road they may have to answer to that, especially if you file a UCC-1 lien against them. Or you
have
get
you ever done that?
No, I haven't had to.
Okay.
I mean, I've got one up now against JP Morgan Chase, and now they're in bankruptcy. So I missed my chance. But again, the idea here is to get them to leave you alone, not to make a profit. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, how much we are in a state of flux now. We don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I have at least 7 or 8 people who are now starting the UCC-1 process. And we'll see.
Does that answer your question, Dave?
I'm sorry, I can't tell you, give you success stories on who actually got that money.
Yes, it does. Thank you. I yield.
All right.
Okay. Was there anybody else that got a question? The star 6.
This is John Texas. I have a question.
Go ahead, John.
If you get a default on a person, can you take them into involuntary bankruptcy?
Involuntary bankruptcy, why?
To get your money.
Okay. Would you please repeat
say
the question?
They were screwed out of a bunch of oil and gas production, and they took it. They stole it with forged documents. And you can, through the Texas Railroad Commission, find out how much it is and go into involuntary bankruptcy, say, for an oil company specifically.
Okay. They're taking out a document against you. I missed your first part of your statement.
Okay. I was recording this on my phone and as well as on the computer, and I messed up. The question is, I have an oil company that forged some documents, and they have been receiving oil and gas production for several years. Is it possible, when I get all this done of the default, that I could take them into an involuntary bankruptcy and get my money? Is that possible?
Why would you do that? Why not just get in touch with the sheriff and have him brought to jail for fraud?
Okay. Because it's a big company, and they give a lot to the city, but they stole this oil and gas. They're not going to do it. I've talked to them about it, and they said They're not going to do anything about it. Money talks.
Talk to your county sheriff. The county sheriff is the highest ranking law officer in the county. And he has an obligation, or she has an obligation, to protect the people in the county.
Well,
she has. They have an oath of office that you have to, you can accept and hold them to it, and say, do your job. Now, you're getting an idea of just how corrupt this government is that we live in. They're actually allowing people to commit crimes like fraud through the mail, extortion under color of law. These are criminal acts. And it should be brought to the attention of your sheriff. And if the sheriff won't do it, then maybe you need to go to the federal marshal and say,
okay,
this is what's been going on. And we need to bring this into, or go to the JAG and bring him into a military court for crimes against the people. That's treason.
Well, one other thing, talking to the sheriff of this county that it's happening to, the people that did this bought cowboy hats to all the county people and the sheriff. It was like spending like $300 a hat. You think that sheriff's going to help me out? And I yield.
Okay. This is one of our problems, because the sheriffs in most of the states have been bought and paid for. That's changing now. Supposedly, Trump has issued a warning to them that they will be held liable in a military tribunal because they're in violation of their oaths. And they are perpetrating crimes against the people. Again, a lot is going to happen in the next 2 months. But if he's still at that stage where he is working for the company and not for the people, then you need to bypass him and go right to the military. Because the military are the trustees for the Republic. And if what he's doing is perpetrating or colluding with someone or conspiring with someone in harming the people, then he needs to be brought up to a military tribunal and tried. And trust me, there are 444,000 arrests worldwide because of what's going on. And we'll see. Gitmo is packed. They had to open up one in Iceland, I think. So a lot of stuff is happening. The most important thing we can do right now is to get the record set up. Get your ducks in a row so that when the dung hits the fan, you can say, well, here is documentary proof of what they owe me.
Ray, I'd like to answer John's question. This is Daryl. To force somebody into an involuntary bankruptcy, it takes three people to sign an involuntary Chapter 7 into effect to the company or to the person that is being addressed. But it takes three parties to force you into an involuntary bankruptcy, I yield.
It's my understanding you can do it with one person. If it's one person on one person, it can be one. I'll research that a little further. I yield.
Okay. Is there anybody else? Okay.
That I have never gone into that, never had any reason to. So that's kind of like I can't help you out there. Sorry.
Okay. There was some other question. Yeah. Go ahead. Dave, Kansas?
Yeah, this is Dave in Kansas.
Yes, go ahead.
I've used the administrative process a little bit, and I've never gotten any money out of it. However, under the civil rules of procedure, which all the procedures are civil procedures, Rule 56 says an unrebutted affidavit stands as truth and judgment. Rule 55 says if your default notice is against an individual, all it takes is a stamp of the clerk of the court to make the default judgment. And in my reading of it, that's the same as you going into court and the judge slamming down his hammer saying judgment in favor of the plaintiff for X number of dollars.
But I'm wonderful.
I've never had to use it because I'm like you. I just want them to go away and leave me alone. Mm-hmm. That's the reason you made a statement earlier that I'd like to reinforce, and maybe you want to use it. You said, and there's a maxim of law to be, for something to be recognized, it must be expressed. And the best way to express it is on paper, as you said, they look at things on paper. And that's the reason my process of accepting their oath of office, I get a hard copy of their oath of office signed or autographed by them and witnessed by someone, usually a judge or another attorney or someone along those lines. I take that oath of office and I write across it in red or blue ink, whichever I have at the time. I, a man called John Henry Doe, standing in God's kingdom, without the United States all caps, accept your sworn oath of office for honor, value, fact, and consideration. Now you and I have a private binding contract that you will honor, protect, and defend all of my God-given and constitutionally declared rights. I date it, take it down to the notary, and get it notarized, and then I present that to them in person, along with a congratulatory and congratulatory speech of them getting elected, and I also give them a copy of the Citizens Rule Book because I found that most of them never read the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. And I say, just like you said, I'm going to hold you to it. And when you do that, the county people, at least in my county here, they leave you alone.
Good for you. Good for you.
But anybody can do that. It's not that hard to do. You know, I got to, in the next 30 days, I have to go down and get all the new, we got a whole new set of commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
But the last time I did it was in 2018 and 2020. All the people that I accepted their oath of office in 2018 didn't run for office in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Good for you.
Okay.
That's how we hold them, you know, hold them to their oaths. And they know what happens if they don't, if they violate their oaths. Especially now that you have it. Yeah, go ahead.
You got two choices. You got a tort claim against them for violating the contract that they created.
Right.
Or you got a criminal complaint against them for violating their oath of office.
That's right.
And using Jack and Margie Flynn's process that they use in their administrative process.
God bless those two.
Section 3 and 4 of the 14th Amendment says if they violate their oath of office, they lose their job and their pension. And
that's
I want
right.
to tell you, those judges out there do not want to lose their pension.
Are you? True that. True that.
Okay.
Man,
is there anybody else?
Very good news. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Does somebody else have a question?
Yeah, there's a lot again.
Okay. Go ahead, Rod. Oregon.
Yeah. In Oregon. Yeah. You know, here in Oregon, you know, they have what they call the revised statutes and so forth. Well, I don't know if I mentioned it before, but they have one ordinance here. It's 336057, and this was put on the books or adopted back in 1923. And basically it said, and you know, I'm paraphrasing it, but basically it stated that every institution of public education in the state of Oregon should have a full curriculum of constitutional studies, beginning with state and country starting from 8th grade on to up to 12th grade and even four levels of college. And to this very day, that has not even been mentioned, let alone implemented. So I'm in the process right now of negotiating or dealing with one of the reps here about putting on books about everybody that gets involved with law enforcement, put the gun and a badge on, should have a full curriculum of constitutional studies before they are allowed. So there would have to be some kind of a curriculum of a test they'd have to take so they would know this. And in other words, like if they flunk it, they got like maybe 30 days to come back and try it again. They get a couple of times, and if they don't, they're not part of. But and this won't probably happen until 26 anyway, because, you know, caught it the wrong late time, but at least we have enough time to work on it. But I have some other people, they're working on a bill to put on the books about all these law enforcement people. They have to know the Constitution, nothing else.
All right, the problem with that is they will not be able to do their job. Because what they're doing, the way the money trail, okay, you follow the money trail. What is the biggest cash cow? Traffic. And if they were following the Constitution, I'd say about 80% of the traffic tickets would not be issued. And
these cops have a
quota. They have a quota to fill every day. They have to write so many tickets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, here in Oregon back in 1985, one of their legislative meetings, it was Paul Mumau, who used to be the director of the DMV here, Department of Motor Vehicles, and he came to the table and asked the legislature if they could pass some kind of a bill to continue to allow them to sell to the public, the traveling public, their registrations and licenses, because he said if they don't, then his agency would lose revenue. So I guess what happened here, from what I gathered, what happened here in Oregon is they put anytime a bill goes through that has a financial impact on the people or anybody, it has to go through the House first, and then it goes to the Senate to, you know, be passed or whatever. Well, apparently they put this bill directly through the Senate, and it was called the optional titling rule. And so this was Kim Mumau, but this was in 85. But they never implemented the optional titling rule until 2005. And it ran for like 7 years, and then they took it out. They completely eliminated the optional titling rule. So right now, here in Oregon, the way I look at it, there's nobody, you can't buy a title or anything for your car or apply for, because there's no option. They took that option out. It's amazing that when people, you know, you understand some of these dynamics that they use, but that's the whole idea of these men having constitutional studies. They always say to serve and protect. What are they serving, and who are they protecting, and how can they protect anything they know nothing about to begin with? I yield.
Go ahead.
Well, you can respond. You can respond, but I'd like the floor when you're finished.
Go ahead, Ray.
There was a Supreme Court justice back in 1946 that said, beware of the administrators of law, of government. They have taken over, and they have nothing to do with Constitution. It's all about money. Money and power. That's what's running this country right now. And you've got a classic example that you just heard right now of how they just take it and manipulate it and create these wonderful ways of forcing people to turn, you know, you're renting your car from the government, right? You have to pay a registration fee every year. And you have to renew your driver's license. You have to pay a registration fee for your land. I mean, it's crazy. It's all it's unconstitutional. So if you were to teach these people the Constitution, how could they do their job?
Blackmail and bribery seems to be the money.
Yeah, follow the money trail. Yep.
Hey, Dave, did you want to comment on that?
Yes, absolutely. So you're right, Ray. How could they do their job? Once they read the Constitution, they would realize that police officers and the state police are both unconstitutional offices. You know, the state
police work at the behest of the governor, and the police department works at the behest of the mayor and the city council. None of them are elected positions by the people, only the sheriff. That's it. Sheriff is the only constitutional law office on the land, and I yield.
That's because of the definition of the words. You see, the government was given permission to regulate interstate commerce. And you are operating a, quote, motor vehicle, which is a conveyance used to transport passengers or cargo for hire. That's commerce. Okay? So, therefore, the Constitution doesn't apply because you are exercising a privilege that was granted by the government for which they charge you. You are not exercising your right of locomotion, which means to go from point A to point B at your own, you know, by whatever means you choose. And so this is why...
That's a private conveyance.
Of course it is. But they're calling it a motor vehicle.
And right, and there's no such thing as a motor vehicle.
Oh, yeah, they defined it. Title 18 U.S.C. 31. Title 18 U.S.C. 31.
Okay.
Motor vehicle, a conveyance used to transport passengers or cargo for hire. Who is a driver? One who operates a motor vehicle for hire. What's a passenger? One who pays to be transported. Those are right out of
the... Is that why they're trying to pass, make combustion engines? They're trying to outlaw combustion engines, and have because an engine is not a motor. A motor is not an engine. A motor is electric.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's another story for another day. There's There's another reason for that. They don't want us traveling in any way, shape, or form. They want to make the smart cities where you live within 15 minutes of anything you need to do by walking or public transportation. You will not have cars. And that's, who is it? Klaus Schwab. You will own nothing. You will eat bugs until you will be happy. Okay. So don't worry about the engine. It's not the engine. It's the use that makes it commercial.
Okay. Is there anybody else with a question on the administrative process?
We kind of got off of it, didn't we?
If I may?
Yeah. Hello.
Yeah. Who's the if I may?
Pam in Michigan. So I just wanted to make a comment there. You said the sheriff. And so you did mention definitions. So would it be share? And you said interstate. So would the IFF regard interstate federal funds? Share the interstate federal funds? I yield.
I'm sorry, I don't know. Interstate federal funds meaning what?
Well, you were referring to the sheriff, and then you also mentioned you have to know the definitions of these things. So I wrote it down, and
yes.
Sheriff would be
interstate. Oh, I see what you're saying. I don't know that. I've never researched that. I just know that that office is the highest ranking law office in the county. It ranks above the governor. It ranks above everybody else in that county, only that county, not the state. And their job is to serve and protect the people. That's their oath. Of course, that's been messed around with, too. It's just like the judge's oath now. They no longer have to give impartial treatment to the people in their court that took that out of their oath. So I mean, the whole thing has been messed around with to the point where it's all about money. Now, I got stopped in Michigan. I got stopped. And anyway, I tried to explain something to the cop, and he called his supervisor. Meanwhile, I'm sitting in the back of his car with my hands handcuffed behind my back. And his supervisor comes,
And he talks to him, and the next thing I know, the door opens. I get out of the car, and the supervisor has him take the handcuffs off, and he says, "You're free to go." And I looked at him, and I said, "You know, you gotta tell these cops what the law is." And he looked at me and says, "No, they're paid to enforce the statutes." It tells you all you need to know.
Very good.
He told you a good statement.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Good call.
If I may.
Okay, who is, if I may?
Scotty, New York, trying to get in.
Go ahead, Scotty.
A couple of little dialogue. As far as the getting the oaths, I have had no luck getting the oaths. I did it. There's a couple of things. You do it on the state FOIA site because I'm trying to get the lawyers that are up in Albany, but it's not the small little Albany. It's the federal Albany. They didn't respond. Mm-hmm. And I had to just take a screenshot of it. That's all digital. And even the screenshot doesn't give you the date and the time like emails. But to tie that, and then when you try to get the oaths here, I'm in Queens, I'm in New York. They're very nice on the phone. They are very nice. If you leave a message, they don't respond. But then still you send the email to the special department of the oath and they don't respond. And it's like real done all nice and proper and stuff. And they just don't respond. So they have learned to, the ladies who are on the phone that are nice, they know me. So when I go there and physically in person, but that's just a little commentary on that. And then as far as the faxes and the registered mail and sending them letters, and it's cost a lot of money, I could add a little to that because I've been doing that since before fax, where you had a real fax machine plugged into the phone line. Now you don't have an app to fax. First, I would send the letter, properly notarized, you know, filed to the court, registered mail. Registered, the court clerk's duty is to put it in the right port. Is it private? Is it public? Is it admiral? So first, I would send the letter and then give them time. And then we'd call on the phone and send them the fax right there, you know, and then call them like as we're doing it right before to confirm. And whoever answers the phone, back when they used to answer phones, and then record the audio of the conversations, the one-party state, New York. And then you still, with emails, you save the emails, and that does have dates and times, and then you print it up. And then you have something, again, that you notarize, and you bring your file in the case, you go there in person, or you do the registered mail trick, and the deal is you're filing it as a... into the case. So it's all additive. Okay. First you do the letter, then you do the fax, then you can do the email. So that's just, and then the other option is you have registered as to the court clerk is very powerful, but you can also do insured. So you get some money back if it doesn't show up there. So I'll yield. I think that's everything I had. Thanks.
Okay. Problem. As far as your oath, you can do a FOIA to the Supreme Court for your attorneys. I yield.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there another question? We can maybe take a couple more questions here, and then we're going to need to close out.
I could add one more point.
Yeah, ma'am.
Who is this?
Yeah, it's John in New Jersey.
Okay, go ahead, John.
I appreciate you, Darryl, and this gentleman talking there. It used to be the land of the free and home of the brave,
okay.
And it's land
What's
of the
your question?
Sea.
What's your
land...
Go
yeah,
to your question.
Well, my question is, how about if you do what Edmund George says, is you own the name, the all capitals name there. You register it as a business, so then you have a... you own that name. So they can't use that name. If they use that name, they got to pay you. I'm just throwing it out there to see what, if anybody else has done that.
Yeah, let's focus on the administrative process, if we can.
Well, the administrative process also works if you are the executor of your estate. And that is something that you inherit by the fact that they have taken the liberty of using your birth, your certificate of live birth, as collateral for the debt of the federal government. Now, under the use, under the Corpus Juris Secundum and the Sexcuque V Act of 1666, you can claim the right of being an executor of the estate nunc pro tunc to when you turned the age of majority. That gives you absolute authority, and there is not a court in this country that is higher than that.
Yeah, I think Phyllis had sent some documents there. I have to review them. But, yeah, you need to claim that all capital's name as yours and as a business, because they're holding you in a corporation.
No.
Paper can only talk to paper. Yeah, you're not a corporation. You're a flesh and blood man. But that's what they... Yeah, this is how they screw you. I very much understand that. And, yeah, it gets very expensive trying to fight these people.
Okay, Ray, did you want to comment on that?
Yes. The way you get around that is you file with the Federal Trade Commission and the Secretary of State of the state where you live. You file what's called a Declaration of Life and a Notice of Appointment to the Office of Executor. Now that they've been put on notice that the office of executor is occupied by a living man, both the executor and the full all capital name is no longer available for commercial use without your permission. And any kind of unauthorized use will cost them $50,000 per occurrence per individual.
In lawful money.
The problem is trying to collect from these. Yeah, well, an affidavit stands as truth in commerce there. And,
But you're not in commerce here. You are a living man exercising your right as a living man and as a higher office. You are above their pay grade. You don't have to have an affidavit because your word is your bond. You're a living man. Okay? Well, you say what you say because you are a living man. They have to clarify everything they do because they're fictions. And they're actors.
That's how they run over you. It's all legal fiction. Yeah, I understand that, Ray.
Okay,
I do appreciate your presentation there. And I appreciate you, Daryl, there. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's take one more question. There was somebody else that had a question.
I just wanted to add one more thing. I had found out from Sister Elvira, the Black's Law video, before they edited out that one sentence, but she had said the first time I watched it, like 2008, that the comptroller is the only one answerable to the people. So when you do this paperwork and the administrative process and you're trying to file stuff in, I would suggest sending it to the comptroller also, I yield.
Okay. Was there another question? Or if not, we'll go ahead and close. Ray, we want to thank you for presenting this here. We kind of got... around a lot of other discussion, but
that's because of where we are as a country, my friend. I apologize. I understand that.
Yeah, it helps to sometimes get the feel of different subjects that you might be dealing with. But anyway, if there's anybody new on the call that does not receive the notices for the Tuesday or Thursday night calls and would like to receive them, you can send Phyllis an email. You'll want your first name, state, who invited you to the call, and a phone number. We do not share any contact information with anyone, but if there's somebody that would want to reach out to you, they will send Phyllis an email, and she will forward that on to you. And it'll be up to you to respond to them at your own convenience. And her email address is blueridge1121 blueridge@gmail.com. That's blueridge1121@gmail.com. So there's a number of other groups that is down on the attachments, and there's other calls throughout the week. You know, we are living in a guaranteed Republican form of government in this country, and we need to work together and to try to break down the walls and let go of the egos and the pride and stuff, and let's bring this country back under the authority of the people, under the limitations of the Constitution that limits the powers that are given to the public servants. And it is up to the people to do this. We cannot ask the beast, you know, to basically do their own way of justice, but we have to hold them to the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution. And that is what all public officials have been required to take an oath to. So that sets up the contract. So I want to thank everybody for coming.
Darryl?
Yes, Kent?
Yeah, I want to say something to clarify this networking process.
Okay, go ahead, Kent.
So we appreciate Phyllis listing the other conference calls and the other groups on the notice. However, we don't have the Republic website developed well enough yet to do the same on the website. But the ALR, Americans, that's plural, for the digit or number four, legalreform.com, is developing their website at a faster rate than many others, and they're trying to make it professional. And during the course of this, they are offering to put other groups up there that may have conference calls, books, etc., to list them on the website. So I would advise people to go to americansforlegalreform.com, and you can go to the networking section, and you can look and see other groups that are listed there. Again, that's not yet complete. We're working on it, and you may find some people on the notice that Phyllis sends out that you won't find there, and vice versa. But we're trying to develop this networking so, as Darryl said, we can get groups to work together. So I just want to be clear, at this point in time, the Americans for Legal Reform is being used as a sample website where we're going to list groups with either a logo and a picture, a bio, and the contact information, preferably a website. If not a website, an email address where people can get in touch with them. And I also want to thank, in addition to that, I want to thank Ray for coming aboard tonight and providing the information that he provided, and we hope to have him back again. Thank you very much, and I yield.
Okay, thank you, Kent. And thank you, everyone, for coming on the call. We hope this your information will be beneficial. And Ray, if you'll consider maybe coming back here in a couple weeks or so. We'll try to work that out.
We did the first one, the first step. There's steps 2 and 3 and 4. So I guess we'll talk about it in a couple weeks.
Okay. Well, then if it'll fit your schedule, then we will kind of look to put something like that together.
Okay.
Because I think this is the authority of the people, and it's actually biblical too. Because what you're doing is you're confronting the trespasser one on one and telling them to validate their claim,
right,
and do it in writing. And if they can't do it, well, then they default, and you give them an opportunity to cure it. And if they don't want to cure it, now you take it to judgment. So. Mm-hmm. This is exercising your Article 3 judicial power, the superior judicial power.
There you go.
Well, with that, is there anybody that would like to close in a word of prayer? If not, then I will. Heavenly Father, we come before you to thank you, Lord, for this opportunity to learn and to listen to the experience that Ray has shared, that he had in doing this process of holding these people accountable. We ask you, Lord, for your wisdom and guidance as we continue to address these forces of darkness that have encamped around us and have filled offices and you've warned us that, about the spiritual wickedness in high places, and it just seems to be all over the place. And we ask you, Lord, for your mercy and your grace as we continue to confront this. We just pray, Lord, that this country can unite once again under the principles that you've given us to follow, that the fulfillment of the law is found in one word. It's the word love. And this is what is lacking in our communities. We just ask you, Lord, to bring us back to your ways and get back to the good way, the old path that you have prepared for us. And we just pray that you continue to prepare the way before us, guide and direct our steps, and deliver us from this force of darkness, that what is said and done is according to your will. And we just pray, Lord, for those that have been in places, in offices, that they will stand to protect the rights of the people and to do their work as it was originally intended for them to follow. And we just commit all these things into your hands in the name of Yeshua. Amen.
Amen.
Well, with that, we'll say good night all, and there'll be no call for Thursday night. It'll be Thanksgiving, so we'll postpone it. So we'll leave it at that. With that, we'll say good night all until we meet again.
Good night.
Daryl. Thank you, Daryl. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah. And next
thank
Tuesday.
Thank you, Phyllis.
Thank you, everybody.
Next Tuesday, I believe we'll have Ed George. We'll be speaking.